Hello, Properly Howard fans. Before we get to our coverage of Shakedown, our affiliates at the Lorehounds have created a website to follow our comings and goings this season. Here to talk about it for a couple of minutes is David from the Lorehounds. I've got David from Lorehound fame with me this morning. David, tell me what's going on with the Lorehounds right now.
Ooh, we're a little busy catching up. We've been hanging in with Shogun, which has been a phenomenal series of television. And we're getting ready for a bumper crop this summer with House of the Dragon, The Bear, Acolyte. Yeah. There was something else I can't remember off the top of my head. So yeah, it's been good. And we onboarded a new podcast for Fallout, one of our really super active Discord users, Aaron, who is also one of our moderators. He roped in a buddy of his, Chase, and they've been podcasting about Fallout. It's called Radioactive Ramblings. So that's really fun. Marilyn's been busy with Rings and Rituals with her and Dr. Sarah Brown. So yeah, we've got a fun little family rolling along here. We're sponsoring a bunch of other podcasts and stuff.
Yeah. So. Well, I'm happy to be at least, a cousin of the family.
My cousin, but hey.
I wanted to ask you, now you did something very kind for Properly Howard. You created a Notion page for us.
Yes.
And I'm really impressed with it. We're about the same age. There are old dads who know about technology, and then there are people like me who eschew technology wherever we can. But I was really impressed with this Notion page. Tell me a little bit about this and why you created it.
Sure. For Properly Howard, I didn't plan it because I'm just a genuine fanboy of Properly Howard. I love the format.
But you seemed especially excited about Felonies and Fugazis, maybe more so than the other seasons of Properly Howard.
I thought the title was great, and it just made me think of all those really sort of Goodfellas era type, movies.
Yeah.
And so I was listening to your draft. I was like, we gotta write it. I gotta write this down. I gotta see where it goes. So I just started throwing it into Notion. And then I just out of that built this little gallery where you can go to the page, and this is available for everyone. You don't have to be a subscriber or anything.
All right. And there's a title. We'll put a link in the show notes of this particular episode. All right. So so you'll go to that page, and at the very minimum, you'll be able to see which movies we're covering.
Correct.
Right. So, which is something that Steve and I have not been great about. So I appreciate that.
It's very helpful. And so I put them in order. So when you land on the page, you'll see them running in left to right order.
Uh-huh.
You see a thumbnail of the, I tried to find original movie posters for them, digital reproductions, or people have scanned them. There is the log line. So you can see what the movie's about. And then, there's also tags for the year, who picked the movie, and then your categories for unlikely partners or
right. Yeah. How which category the movie falls into according to our draft, right?
Yep. So then if you click on the tile, it'll open up a little side page and you can see all that information. But then I also embedded links for IMDb and Letterboxd. So if people want to follow through a little bit more.
Nice.
And then I'm starting to record your Properly Howard ratings.
Oh, very good.
So, that's very good. So on Point Break.
This all sounds so official. I'm so happy that you stepped into the void here.
What I'm also doing is once the podcast drops, I will embed the podcast in there. But I've also embedded the trailers. So if you click through and you're curious, like, do I really want to watch this film or whatever? You can then also see the trailer quite quickly. And then I've also added links. If somebody's a Plex user, Plex is a online streaming kind of platform thing. And if they have trouble finding the original movie, there's a way to request Plex access to see the movie.
Now, I wanted to ask you, David, since we're covering Felonies and Fugazis, what do you think is missing from this particular list that you would like to see on this list?
I think something from the genre of the heavy-duty mobster category. So a Goodfellas, a Casino.
I think that those are really good ones. I guess we didn't really do a hard-hitting mafia kind of movie on this list. And I think that's absolutely an oversight. Thank you for mentioning that. I think that sometimes with this podcast, we try to go for hidden gems. not always, you know, it's like, you know, I did go Pulp Fiction, which is, should be coming up for us, but,
Rocky, that's a, you know, an epic movie.
Right. But you wouldn't think of Rocky as a crime movie usually. So yeah, maybe we're erring on not too many of the deep cuts and not enough of the, you know, the greatest hits. So, okay, that's good. And which is your favorite of those kinds of movies?
I think Goodfellas is just such a great historical overview of, you know, mafia history in modern history. And it's got such compelling characters and it's got such a pacing. And then when you hit that final chapter of it and just the speed at which it's rolling forward, it's a movie that really carries me. And I can just think of the scenes and I smile or I'm like, wow.
Yeah,
or,
you know, it is absolutely one of these movies that you can watch 50 times.
Yeah.
And there's enjoy so much every time. To it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a quick question before we bounce out? What is the ending music for Properly Howard? Because I honestly listen all the way through because I love that song. I get a pep in my step.
It's a great song. It is the intro music to the film The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Oh.
The original. And for me, it connotes a particular era in movie making.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. And just that robust horn section, the percussiveness of the song. I just get pumped every single time I hear that song.
I do too. Like genuinely.
It comes from a particular era of movie making that I think is passed us by.
Absolutely.
But it's a banger of a song for sure.
I'm so glad that you have it.
Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the 1988 action crime thriller Shakedown. Shakedown is part gritty cop story, part courtroom drama, and part live-action Looney Tunes cartoon. Peter Weller stars as a tenor sax playing lawyer with bad taste in ties, who works alongside Sam Elliott, who plays a no-nonsense cop with a history of involuntary dog slaughter, and he is not afraid to weaponize a roller coaster. With me to discuss this film, as always, is Dr. Anthony Ladon.
Steve, does anyone sit at a bar like Sam Elliott?
Nobody can. I mean, we all try, right? I mean, I think that's... It's funny because there are those who have seen Sam Elliott in a movie sitting at a bar, and there are those that don't, and that shows anytime you go to a bar. Anyone that's sitting straight up or anyone that's just kind of just looking like a regular, just an average Joe, they've never seen. Because as soon as you see it, you're like, oh, that's what you got to do. I got to do a slight hunch, cock the head just a little bit to the left, a wry smirk. Act as if you have a mustache, you know. I wipe away, you know, beer from a mustache. It's non-existent.
For those who do not know Sam Elliott, what has he been in? What would they know him from?
Flannel.
He's one of these actors where, like, everyone's seen him in a movie, and he's always pretty memorable, but for some reason, he's not, like, a household name. He's one of these guys. He was the guy in The Big Lebowski. No, not Goodman, not Buscemi. He's the other guy. So what do you think is his most memorable role?
See, that's a really interesting question, because I actually had a conversation with somebody about Sam Elliott, and it's like, you know, what is his most memorable role? Like, what is he known for? I mean, like, he's, you know, he's been in some big films, and he's had a real, you know, a prominent effect on a lot of those films. Like, you know, he's in Roadhouse, for example, you know, and Mask, and, you know, Tombstone.
He's the hippie boyfriend. He shares hippie boyfriend and Mask, right?
Right. He's the...
He's in Tombstone. He's the older, deep voice brother in Tombstone. Yeah.
He's sort of this, you know, figure of wisdom in The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah. He's the narrator. And yeah. I mean, he's been in a lot of stuff, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
He was famously in a really great episode of Parks and Rec,
right?
Where he's the liberal equivalent to Ron
Swanson. Yeah,
yeah, he's sort of like the yin to Swanson's yang. That was a great role for him, but he's not usually cast as the lead, right? He's more of a,
unless it was The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot.
Oh, I didn't see that one. All right, so he was the lead in that, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I think people know who we're talking about. So even in this film, he's kind of second banana, right?
Yeah, and kind of surprisingly so, because the cover of the film would have you believe that it's sort of a 1A, 1B, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With Peter Weller. He is. I mean, he's the closest thing to the next biggest actor and with screen time and everything, but it's interesting how maybe infrequently their paths cross. Like, a lot of the stuff they do is without each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they do get together, it's usually pretty comically cartoonish.
It's a mayhem. I was trying to describe this film. I was like, it's like an episode of LA Law with a Jackie Chan movie peppered in at times.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and I mean it's a lot of genres.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of fitting into our Felonies and Fugazis crime series here, but it really almost is a courtroom drama with,
right, at times, for sure,
with the movie Scarface.
Yeah, right.
Merge, you know, overlaid with the movie Scarface, overlaid with the movie Heat, overlaid with a bunch of Jackie Chan action sequences.
Yeah.
It's got some heavy saxophone when the love story's coming in.
I mean, it's a great everything. The sax is definitely there, so you get a little Lethal Weapon.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's the movie assumes you know a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like the relationship between these two characters, like it just assumes you would just know that, you know, there's this lawyer who's really wants to be a tenor sax player. But, you know, he got into law because, you know, he was convinced that he wasn't really going to make a living playing tenor sax exclusively.
His family, his father and his family thought he was a loser.
Yeah.
Because it was you're never going to make any money playing tenor sax.
But, like, he never feels quite himself like he does when he's playing tenor sax.
He can just play forever. That's forever. What he wants to do.
Yeah.
But that is not the New York he's living in. The New York he's living in is not going to reward him for playing the tenor sax.
No, and he doesn't play it at all in this movie, which really shows his how distant he is from his passion. And then he just sort of knows Samuel Elliott's character, mm-hmm. and knows that he sleeps in a movie theater. Lives in a movie theater, brushes his teeth in a movie theater with baking soda.
I was going to ask you about that. So this guy, this is the Elliot character. His name's Richie. He's a cop and at least a pretty successful cop, at least because he's not wearing, you know, street blues. He's wearing blue jeans.
It's very important to know the blue jeans.
That's right.
Which, by the way, this movie internationally is known as Blue Jean Cop.
I saw that. He's from Texas, so he's kind of an outsider to the force. And, you know, he goes and fishes in the East River on his off hours. I don't know where he's going to cook these fish because he lives in a movie theater. So
right. You just throw that in there with the popcorn if you get a chance.
Fish corn?
That's right. He invented popcorn shrimp, essentially.
Do the fish come out of the East River already cooked?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what he's fishing for is edible and to begin with.
So he does what I will do, and that is I will fall asleep during the action sequence. I don't know what it is about these movies that, like, you think it was like the lull, you know, when it's really quiet and pondering, I would fall asleep.
Right.
But it's usually like if there's four or five punches in a row, I'm out like a light. And I guess this guy is sleeping to an action sequence in one of the director's previous movies. So
The Exterminator, right?
The Exterminator. But he's sleeping through an action sequence. And I thought, that I like that. That's me. That's exactly what I'm going to do in a movie theater. But he seems to live there.
At least temporarily.
And I'm just assuming, like, he decided he wanted to be a cop in New York City for some reason. And, you know, maybe he didn't fit in Texas. I don't know. For all I know, he was a bad cop in Texas and he thought, I need to go to New York where everyone's a bad cop. Then he gets there and maybe rent is too high, do you think?
Then hire the new. Oh, when he's in New York, yeah. I mean,
he gets to New York City. He gets the job as the corrupt police officer. The rent is just too high.
Well, my understanding is that he's in a relationship, and he's on the outs right now. Mm. That's as Roland comes in and tells him. You know, I forget exactly the name. Says so and so said, if you're willing to, you know, you can go back. If you're willing to.
Oh, that's, you know, right.
Own up to, and then he's like, "It's what you got to look forward to," because he's, in, you know, because Roland's engaged, and so Richie Marx is letting Roland know that, you know, this is his fate if he decides to get married. Mm-hmm.
So I've got a little something I want to play you, and I think you're gonna like this a lot.
Rain like hell that day. Had an umbrella. Moving back to her apartment. She went to the bathroom. I sat on the couch. She had this great big damn dog. The dog had a ball. I threw it. The dog brought it back. I threw it again. Harder.
Harder.
I'll never forget the sound of that dog's paws on the newly waxed floors. How was I supposed to know she left the window open? A dog fell 13 stories, landed on top of a parked car. I went over, leaned out the window, looked down, threw up, and left. Left. Without ever telling her, she was the one.
It's an amazing sequence to really think about and to parse. For one, it's like it was their first date, and he was going to tell her she was the one. So maybe he dodged a bullet, right? I mean, also, she's pooping, right? I mean, like, she's gone for a long time. I mean, they go in, she goes to the bathroom. He makes it very clear that's where she is. And then he's on the couch. He plays fetch twice. A dog going down 13 stories is, you know, I mean, takes a little bit. And he gets up and throws up. And I would have loved it if at that point, if he would still was just like in an alternate universe, he's like, you know what? Dog be damned, I'm going to let her know she's the one, even with little Chunder and mustache.
So I like to think of this from the woman's perspective. They meet at Shakespeare.
She's telling a very different story, by the way, to her friends.
She meets him at Shakespeare in the Park.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's a lawyer.
Right.
It's raining.
Already off to a good start. Lying to her.
For some reason, everyone loves lawyers in this town. So right. Then he goes back. They go back to her apartment. She goes into the bathroom for maybe it's a little while, but it's not going to seem as long to her, right?
Sure.
She's got to just get done what she needs to get done. She comes out. There's barf all over her floor. The lawyer's gone. The window's open. And she looks down and sees her dog splattered on a parked car.
All right.
This is a pretty bad first date for her. And she's probably wondering, like, what did I do? Like, what?
She's like, I thought I was the one. If only he would have verbalized it.
What did I do wrong to deserve this kind of response? I thought he liked me.
So good. And I love it because this is like, the story is being told in the midst of a lot of really interesting stuff. I mean, there is all kinds of activity going on. And again, I'm like, how do these guys know each other? Because he picks them up at the movie theater just so like matter of fact, like, all right, well, it's time to get my down on his luck cop friend around, and who knows, maybe we'll get him to shoot him up on a motorcycle.
So they're in a bar, and I think that they're trying to trade stories about like how the world's a hard place, right?
Right. Yeah. One guy says, "I wish I could play saxophone more," and the other one's like, "I killed a dog," and it's like, "All right, well, we're peeling back some layers."
Later in this movie, they're going to come face to face with the Shocker from Spider-Man. He he literally shocks people to death. Like, there's some horrible stuff going on in New York City. You know,
New York's wild.
The cops are dirty. There's crack on every corner. Even, you know, you can't even get a place to rent. You gotta sleep in the movie theater. This guy is haunted by the dog that went out the window.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is, it's like, really, the biggest regret is not telling her she was the one. See, I think the dog is up there higher for me. Like there's a woman I just met that I didn't get a chance to say I was really smitten with, but there's also a dog I just met that I killed.
I love the detail about the barf.
Yeah, the barf is great. I mean, the cadence of that story is you learn so much about this individual in that little story. And like, this is the kind of scene that would be deleted in many other like action crime dramas. But this one, I'm like, forget it. You build the whole movie around this. I could watch those. If the movie was just Boilermakers with Elliot, I mean, I'm in.
So you would think that
we spent a lot of time talking about this one sequence in this movie, and this movie is bonkers all the way around it.
I want to ask you, because I feel like I would have liked this movie if it had more Sam Elliott in it. But Peter Weller is pretty impressive in this movie, and I want to ask you this question: do you think that he's too good of an actor for this movie?
Well, that's okay. So Peter Weller is an interesting case too, right? So like, we just talked about, you know, Sam Elliott and what he brings, and you know, maybe not often a leading man, but always adds a certain gravitas and a certain something, right? But then you have Peter Weller, who has a kind of an odd little filmography himself. Right, I mean, he's Buckaroo Banzai, and he shows up in a lot of kind of odd flicks. Sometimes they tend to be a little bit more, you know, maybe feels a little more artsy. at times, but then other times, like, kind of schlocky. Mm-hmm. So it's like he seems like he's a guy that, like, is often asked maybe to elevate something that might otherwise be maybe not taken as seriously, perhaps.
You think that's like, the I don't same know with RoboCop?
Well, RoboCop, what smartly they do with RoboCop is, like, you know, even though there was all this talk about, like, oh, do we get Schwarzenegger? Do we get somebody big like that? Taking kind of, like, Weller can do the everyday man kind of thing, right? He can kind of be your average Joe, but still adding a sense of elegance to the performance. Like in RoboCop, I mean, he has, you know, he's kind of this charming, aw shucks cop in a way, mm-hmm. in the beginning. Like, not like cheesily done, but he just, like, I find in a movie where he's so, there's so little of him as a full human in it, he does a lot with those scenes, I think. Like, he makes, I've always found Murphy to be very sympathetic. And, but yeah, not
I
like,
was impressed by that performance in that movie. I was, because I think I'm kind of a late to the Weller party.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I really appreciated him. But what he did with RoboCop, which was otherwise a, you know, pretty standard action movie, you know, with big action set pieces and outlandish scenes. The villains in the movie are over the top. And then you've got this really interesting, subtle performance by Weller. And I almost feel like that might be the same thing in this movie.
Yeah, there's... I was actually pretty impressed, yeah, because I've only seen this movie once, I think, like, close to when it first came out. And but it always stuck with me. Like, a lot of the scenes stuck with me. So it was kind of a nice surprise to revisit it and realize, wow, the scenes that stuck with me were... I was always surprised when they showed up, because mm-hmm. the movie doesn't present itself like this kind of movie that's going to have death by roller coaster. It doesn't, you know, where Sam Elliott, instead of going down the stairs, he jumps on like a light pole that then falls down onto a bus. And then he jumps onto a motorcycle with a sidecar to knock them off. And at that same time, Peter Weller, who took the stairs, shows up right there and gets on the back of the motorcycle.
No, Sam Elliott does not like the stairs. He does not. He doesn't mind going upstairs. He just doesn't ever want to go down a flight of stairs.
Apparently.
He would rather take the storm drain and destroy property on the way down.
Unbelievable. It was so, it's such a, but that scene just, like, because it goes from, like, everything just seems like sort of like, I'm kind of into it. I mean, there's definitely an interesting directing style that feels a little, it's hard to describe. Like, there's a, it feels like a throwback in many ways. Like, it does feel like if you told me this movie was made in the 70s, you know, and, the, mm-hmm. and there's a certain grittiness to the direction style early on, and especially the dynamic between, you know, the crack dealer and the police. And so I kind of like, oh, I'm kind of digging in for something here. And then it's like, oh, then there's this very odd bust of this underground, very high-end crack den.
mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of stuff going down in that
den. And you need grenades to get in.
Yeah, you know? Well...
Yellow
I like,
grenades.
The trope with, you know, the trunk opens, and who's ever responsible for the weaponry says, do you see anything you like?
Yeah, and yeah.
Richie just looks... at the array of possible weapons, he takes two grenades, two bright yellow grenades.
Yeah, bright yellow grenades. Really interesting.
All right, so that is in the same movie that has this scene.
Of course not. I already said I wasn't there, but it's obvious what happened.
No, I submit to you that it is not obvious what happened. It is not obvious, but it is fair to say that you assumed what happened because you were not there, Officer Varelli, and you did not see what happened.
Right. I already said that. Right.
And your assumption was that Patrick O'Leary, in the middle of a narcotics arrest, was shot by Michael Jones. But since you were not there, you could assume anything. You could assume, as a matter of fact, that maybe Patrick O'Leary shot himself. Or maybe you could assume, because you were not there, that Patrick O'Leary did not identify himself as a police officer because his badge was not out. And you could assume, Officer Varelli, that Patrick O'Leary pulled his gun out first and shot Michael Jones, planning to kill him and steal his money and his drugs.
Objection!
Could you assume that, Officer Varelli?
Bullshit.
Mr. Dalton, you will please approach the bench.
So this is a courtroom drama.
Yeah, there's actually several scenes that are actually kind of gripping.
And it's actually like they're almost going for something close to realism in the courtroom drama. It's like he's a pretty good courtroom lawyer and he's trying to submit evidence. And then, of course, but, the, you know, he's bringing the evidence too late to the party. For some reason, the street crane that attaches itself to the taxi.
That wow,
that what hovers him scene. Over the courthouse and then drops him on the step of the courthouse. Like, that's not over the top, but as soon as he goes in the courthouse, the judge is like, oh, we're not going to submit this. This is ridiculous.
That's okay. That's why I think this movie is pretty freaking amazing, right? It'll go from, like I said, you know, it goes from the verdict to, you know, like super cop.
Yeah.
And then back to the verdict again. Like, you know, there's this big tip about this evidence, right? There's this whole scene where Sam Elliott's character gets tipped off by like kind of a scared, on the beat cop. Right.
Yeah.
And tells him, hey, no, there's evidence that will show, you know, that, the cop is dirty on the take or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's this whole thing. Right. So finds out about it and he goes and Peter Weller goes to get it. And the cops, because they're all against him, even if they're not necessarily on the take, which some clearly are, he's also defending what they see as a cop killer, right? So he's like, you know, he's public enemy number one in a police precinct.
Yeah, so he tries to break in. They catch him.
Well, so they
torture him and play Russian roulette with his forehead.
Right. And then they decide, okay, well, we're just gonna kill him. We're just gonna kill him right here in the precinct until Samuel Elliott is told where he is by the guy who wants to kill him.
He busts in, he shoots the cops.
Yeah.
Then he jumps in a cab, Peter Weller jumps in a cab. The cab driver knows his constitution. Mm-hmm. He loves America, so he's gonna get that. He's gonna
wacky immigrant trope.
He's gonna get the lawyer to the court on time. There's a car chase that ends with a construction crane that lifts the cab over the crowd, drops it onto the courtroom steps. He runs in, and the judge is like, "No, we're not gonna submit this into evidence. It's too late. Let's hear your closing arguments, counselor."
That whole entire sequence that included a crane happening to hit the windshield of a taxi. And then instead of being like, oops, this is a real problem, lifts him up over the police barricade so that he can now have some sort of safety by being on the courthouse steps, which I don't know the law real well, but I didn't know that if a police officer has a gun to somebody after getting craned over a police barricade after a police chase, mm-hmm. that a judge can say, you have, you know, you're in charge of the law on the streets, but on these courthouse steps, I am the law. And then I'll have my wacky bailiff keep an eye on this massive team of crooked cops. And the other part of it is, I'm like, well, he's not even on the steps. He's still like, you know, a good like block away. So I'm not really sure. But I watched that scene over and over again. And I was like, how and who was the crane guy working with? They're like, oh, no, that was an accident.
I like to think that was the cousin of the cab driver, maybe.
Like, I mean, it's a crazy sequence. It's this massively orchestrated sequence that at the end, like that starts from him getting the tip off about the tape, to trying to get the tape, to stealing the tape, to getting beat up and getting ready to be killed, to getting craned over a police barricade, only to find out that, like, well, that was for nothing.
It's for nothing because that tape was not submitted improperly into evidence. So this is the same movie that just used a crane to get him to the court on time. that movie has the sensibility to say, no, there's, you know, there are rules. We're
See, and that's the, and I think what it is this goes to show, this movie is showing you, look, we have a judicial system. It may not be perfect, but it is set up by a set of rules, right? It is set up by this set of rules, and then you try to follow these rules, and then sometimes those rules get in the way of justice being served. But out there on the streets, it's mayhem. Out there on the streets, you know what, you're looking for order? Well, good luck. Sometimes you need a serendipitous crane to get through life, but you can't plan for it. You can't adjust for it. You just have to react to it. So ultimately, this whole movie is the two ways you can play tenor sax, right? You can play it note for note, and you can be polished. You may not be the lead in a band, but you definitely will probably have a nice little backing role. Mm. However, if you want to really play tenor sax, you got to be willing to play jazz. You got to be willing to hit those off notes. You got to be willing to improvise. You got to be. That's why what we see is look, he wants to get into the insurance game because that's safer. That's tenor sax played note by note. This man is jazz, baby, and that's the world he needs to live in. Sam Elliott weaponizes a roller coaster.
Right. As a guy with a knife comes at him and runs away, he decides he's going to immediately get on top of a roof. He's not going to chase him directly. He's going to get on top of a roof at Coney Island.
He likes his heights, man. He likes his heights.
And go up a roller coaster. Break the engine of the roller coaster so that the guy so that the roller coaster flies off of the tracks. Is this film trying to tell me something about like the system being corrupt? Because at the end of the day, nothing really changes. Like a couple bad guys get blown up in a plane, right?
Yeah, and Sam Elliott almost causes 9/11. That's nuts, man. That ending sequence, if you were to watch the first 30 minutes of this movie, right?
Yeah.
And then you watch the last 5 minutes of this movie, you're like, what happened? How did we get here? It's crazy. First 30 minutes, we've got dirty cops, we've got courtroom stuff,
yeah.
And then the last sequence, Sam Elliott is hanging on the landing gear of a private jet over the city of New York, shooting it while he's hanging on it, and they almost hit one of the World Trade Centers, but they narrowly avert it, and then he takes one of his golden grenades.
Did
that
he
never
have the
leaves
grenade
the house
in his pocket the whole time?
I guess so. I don't know if he keistered that grenade, but he throws that in there, jumps into the water, and they land and explode. I don't know. This movie is so funny. Like, I watched it, and then I went back and I watched several scenes over and over and over again. That one being one of them. The dog story for sure.
All right.
And but it never refers back. It's like, he just, like Peter Weller's not like, wow, that was crazy. I can't believe that just happened to me. It's like, well, got to go to court and cheat on my fiance, I guess.
So, all right. Most of the time with crime dramas, it'll be some commentary on, like, the cops have to become monsters to fight the monsters on the street. Or it's, hey, cops, robbers, not that different at the end of the day. Or, hey, these criminals have honor, and maybe they even have more honor than the police officers. Or maybe it's like, look how dark the system is. Look how fundamentally corrupt this entire system is. Let's put a spotlight on this so we can see exactly how bad things are. This movie does none of that. What this movie does is...
Got no time for that.
It plays with this idea of like a good cop amidst a sea of bad cops. But even then, the good cop from Texas, he's a pretty bad cop too. Like he
steals the bad cop's Porsche.
He steals the bad cop's Porsche.
Just because.
He's got a clean gun that he can threaten criminals with.
Oh, yeah.
And tell them he's going to throw them in the East River.
File it under DSAF.
That's right.
Doing society a favor.
The lawyer, the idealistic lawyer, he doesn't really take down the cops. Like all these cops are on the take. They're all corrupt.
But that doesn't get exposed.
It does not get exposed. This movie ends with a grenade. And the grenade the grenade blows up. The bright yellow grenade blows up this private jet. And the movie's over. And where it ends is not like, hey, we took down this corrupt system. It's like, no, you get to be a public defender again.
The big win is that his fiance miscarries.
All right.
That's like a huge win.
All right. No.
That's a big scene.
I know. I've got to play you something here.
Like, we're all going to sit there and be like, oh, good.
People like him belong in jail. I can't believe you want him out.
Gail, honey, I don't necessarily want him out. I just don't want him in for something he didn't do.
Who cares if he did it? If he didn't do this, he damn sure did something else. Who gives a fuck if he's innocent?
Well, I do. I give a fuck.
For Christ's sake, this man sells death to school kids.
Gail, hey, sweetie. What's going on here, huh? Come here. Now, what's all this about? Huh? Is this some kind of panic that I'm going to take a left turn on your dad's offer about his law firm?
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah?
I just don't understand your fascination with all this.
Hey, it's all in your mind. I'll call about the apartment, I promise. I'll call tomorrow. All right?
Okay. And you love me, right?
I love you.
A lot.
A lot. Okay, so here's my thesis about this movie. This is not a movie about a corrupt system. It's not a movie about dirty cops. It's not even a courtroom drama, really. This is like a lot of other 80s movies that are preoccupied with what money will do to the soul of a man, an otherwise good man. There's so many movies in the 80s where it's like, this guy, he could be a good guy, but he's chasing the money. He's going to lose his soul chasing the money. He's otherwise idealistic. He likes Jimi Hendrix, right? So he
made very clear as he makes his little homemade Orange Julius.
Yeah, he's not as racist as all of the other lawyers and cops and whatever.
He likes a funky tie, man.
He likes a funky tie, but a girl broke his heart. And after that, he's kind of lost his direction. And what he's done is he's latched himself on to a wealthy girl who has a wealthy father, and he's going to get in on some kind of, he's going to get on the American dream, the American dream. He's going to be a big partner at a law firm. He's going to chase money because his heart is broken. What ends up happening is that girl, that old flame comes back into his life, and he gets his bearings again. And he decides, I don't need the money. I'm actually good at public defending. And that is what I'm going to do with my life. And that's sort of like the indicator at the end. It's like, oh, she was faking the pregnancy? Forget that. I am absolutely going to go back to public defending. The corrupt system is going to remain corrupt, but at least this one honest lawyer in New York City gets to embrace the idealism of the law again. And I think you could say that about a lot of 80s movies. There's something about this worry that we've lost the ideals of the 60s and 70s, and the 80s are all about money. It's all about materialism, and we need our hero to learn that at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely that, right? Like, he returns back to from whence he came, and it's, you know, it's very bookended scene where he's back in the trenches,
yeah,
going to see another client, and that is juxtaposed with the lavish dinner setting where I guess where they were gonna be talking engagement stuff, I think is what it was, right? And the
where
next
she
steps.
Reveals either was a miscarriage or the pregnancy was a fake, but whatever the case is,
she says the rabbit didn't die, and so either, but she announces that I think she announces she lost the baby, right? Because I think both are like, I think one is implied, right?
That maybe, 'cause she just told him that she was never pregnant in the first place.
'Cause she even said, I didn't want to lose you.
Yeah.
So she was going to entrap. So then she tells the, you know, so rather than say that, she tells everybody that they lost the baby. And then, so he's looking around and he's like, well, dude, I'm out. And so like, he basically gets up to make an announcement like during this whole thing. So from their perspective, she just announced that they lost the baby. And he's like, yeah, I'm leaving you. I mean, that's a wild dinner party, dude. That's like thinking you're on a roller coaster and then it just launches off and kills you.
But what do you think about my thesis that this is pretty typical to 80s movies, that it's like it has to have some kind of commentary on the financial state of the country?
Well, I think, and yes, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think you hit the nail on the head too when you specified a man losing his soul.
That's right.
A man, because it is, the female characters in this movie are not they're not strong. They are not. I mean, they're okay. One, his old flame is the assistant DA, but they have this whole like argument out because like he hasn't told his fiance about wanting to leave her and all this stuff. And then so basically she gives him some big lecture that's like all about him. It's all about, hey, you have to do what you have. Like, she's nothing really in this conversation. It's not about how she feels, about how she's being treated. It's all about like him, like he becomes the center point of even her life, and him doing the right thing for him is really important. And then so we get the other painted picture of this fiance who, you know, I mean, okay, we find out she doesn't know who Jimi Hendrix is, so that's weird. And then she fakes a pregnancy, and then they have that scene that you just played where like she's not wrong from like a moral standpoint. Like, she is with a guy.
I don't think
that
she quite understands the idea of a public defender. Like,
right, which is also a weird thing, because you're gonna marry him and you don't know what he does. But I mean, so her reaction to this was like, it could have been like a real nice learning moment for the two of them, right? Mm-hmm. Where they could say, are we compatible, knowing that this is my job, at least at this moment. And you may see that this is, I'm setting a villainous person free based on the technicalities of law. And then it just sort of gives her one of these, you're being hysterical moments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, maybe you're just upset because you don't think that I'm going to take that job from your dad. Is that what this is really about? And then she's written to just play right along with it. Well, maybe. You know, and that's,
it's all in your mind, man.
And it's all in your mind. And that's where Weller, like, this is going back to what you're talking about with Weller. I think Weller can take material that might be a little questionable and just, he's pretty earnest about the characters he plays, and I think he pours a little bit into it.
I think he's too good for this movie. It's actually a pretty legitimately great acting performance in this movie.
Well, and so you say he's too good for this movie. I think it's a blessing, because this is a movie that, like, if you don't have a Weller performance, well, first off, Sam Elliott also. I mean, Sam Elliott's not necessarily playing off type. But like, if you had cast any other two people in this that were maybe like B grade or whatever, no one cares.
I think maybe we've already solved this. I think that early on we discovered that this is really like four different genres of movie put together.
Right.
I think that at least one of the movies that this filmmaker is trying to make is really helped by Peter Weller.
Well, I think I could have watched all four of these movies, right? Because I think Peter Weller and sort of as like sort of a ragtag, you know, rock and roll type lawyer is interesting. I thought it was interesting. I actually liked his performance in the courtroom quite a bit. I found it to be authentic. I love it when he was like completely disheveled and still just nailing it, you know? I mean, I really liked that. I like I like Sam, watching a Sam Elliott as like a good cop, but not necessarily a pure cop, you know, working amongst a sea of mulleted bad cops.
He's not a good cop.
He's not on the tape.
He's not on the tape, but he's absolutely a bad cop because, being from Texas, he doesn't understand the concept of a skyrise. because being on the 13th floor, he doesn't quite get that. You can't play fetch with the dog when the window's open.
Right. There's a lot of things about heights he clearly doesn't understand, right? Like, I mean, he hangs onto a plane flying through the air. You know, no, I, like, he just, I don't think he understands. He might have depth perception issues, right? And so.
His mustache is obstructing his vision.
That's what it is. There's another movie I want to watch, though, where it's just Peter Weller and Sam Elliott on motorcycles shooting. I mean, it's crazy. Like, what is their relationship? Because at the end of the courtroom situation, right, like, the guy gets found innocent of being murdering a cop necessarily. And then it's like, okay, great. And then he just books it out of there. And then Sam Elliott's waiting for him with the Porsche that he stole from the cop that was killed. And it's like, you want to drive or you want to shoot? I'm like, you're the cop. Why does the lawyer have the option? Why are you waiting for him anyway? What is he?
That whole
sequence. It's so great where he's just like, man, I hope he wraps up this trial soon. I just found out. Like, no, go get him. You ever waited for anybody in court or for any kind of proceeding? You don't know when it's going to end. And he's just all, you want to drive or you want to shoot? Why don't I let the cop shoot?
In Texas, the lawyers drive or shoot. They don't do both.
That's amazing.
It's a state law.
And there's so many other ways that I felt like they could have stopped them from flying. I don't know.
All right, let's move on to the is there one tweak that you would make to this movie to improve it?
I think the easy tweak would just be like, you know, pick a lane, right? That's not like a slight tweak, but I think I would want a little more. I mean, honestly, I loved the whole crane sequence, but like even just a voiceover at one point going, I can't stop this crane, or just something. Because it did take me a long time. I'm like, is the crane guy in on this? And then there's like, oh no, it's just, he's really, really bad at his job.
How many cabs has he picked up that day?
Right.
It's just Tuesday. It's only been 4 cabs.
I mean, maybe a little more Sam Elliott. Maybe I think would be.
I think more Sam Elliott for sure. I was going to say this movie is a little bit like one good white guy in the midst of a lot of racists.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of, we're supposed to read his lack of racism as, oh, well, he's a nice guy. And then at the end, you know, because of course the dirty cop hates rap music, right?
Right, right.
And then immediately.
Which, by the way, was Red Hot Chili Peppers. Okay, so let's all settle down.
And then immediately we go to Weller's apartment where he's making a shake. Wait, no, it's like a smoothie or something?
Yeah, like orange Julius with a little bit of instant Folgers.
It was like milk, orange juice, egg, and Maxwell House.
Oh, yeah, Maxwell House. Yeah, good. Yeah.
So, again, not sure how good this guy is, but he likes Jimi Hendrix. He's even got like a Jimi Hendrix poster. So you're thinking, oh, well, he's not racist because he can't be racist, of course. He likes,
right, exactly.
He likes Jimi Hendrix, right? But then at the end of the movie, they try to show that he's morally superior to his client. Stand up and face me. Like, there's a little bit of white superiority in this at the end. So I feel like you didn't need that, and it almost... Like, if you're going to make everyone in this movie dirty, then do that. But don't try to make this one guy, like, this is the one non-racist guy in all of New York City.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, from the racism perspective, sure. He is a guy that spends a good chunk of this movie cheating on his fiance. So in terms of...
His fiance is pretty bad.
In terms of Heart of Gold, yeah, but he doesn't know. See, the thing is, he doesn't know she's faking the pregnancy. In fact, he thinks she's pregnant while he's still actively cheating on her. So, I mean, just keep that in mind.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, he's probably just engaged to her for the money anyway, right?
So also, maybe not good. Which I think is good. I think it's good to have some flawed main characters. But it does seem a little inconsistent in how they're trying to portray him.
I think so.
Because I think the way that the movie is designed, and this might be going back to some of the latent, you know, misogyny that's in it, or maybe not latent, but, you know, apparent, is is that like we're supposed to, I think, be okay with the fact that he's with his infidelity, because
that's his old flame, right?
Because he's and it's ultimately what we are supposed to believe is best for him. So kind of consequences be damned, because he's the center of this universe.
Well, we don't want to see him marry for money, right?
Right. I guess.
So, is there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you enjoyed in this film?
Sam Elliott's mustache.
Does he not have a... I was rewatching a few scenes of Roadhouse, and it looks like he's not wearing the mustache in Roadhouse.
It's just not as prominent. It's for sure there. I've seen him without his mustache. It's unsettling.
Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
This is probably the toughest question, and I'll tell you why. Because I think Ron Howard makes a more cohesive film and probably leans way more into the courtroom drama and maybe some of the relationship issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get a roller coaster, and I don't get a near 9/11. So it's a real tough one, because of the four movies, I think two of them are maybe three of them are a Howard minus four, but there's one that's a Howard plus three. You know,
yeah. I gotta say, this is a Howard negative three. I think Howard picks a lane. It's interesting. Like, I think, what was his film debut, directorial debut? It was the one with Winkler and Michael Keaton.
With Night Shift?
Night Shift. That's a, you know, sort of a New York City, I mean, they're corrupt coroners and pimps.
Sure.
But it is kind of like that wacky After Dark New York movie. So we know he can do something along those lines.
Right.
But, yeah, but, you know, pick a lane.
What's his grittiest movie?
Howard's grittiest movie.
Because I don't know if he really does gritty, right?
That's a great question.
Because, I mean, I'm looking at it. I mean, is it Backdraft? You know, I mean... Ransom, perhaps?
You know what? Maybe Ransom, in a way. But, you know, Night Shift, it's about coroners turned pimps, there's prostitutes. I mean, that's pretty gritty.
In terms of, like, it's a gritty comedy. Yeah, so the thing is that I don't know we have a real good, grit comparison.
I think Night Shift is analogous, at least.
Well, then this movie's better than Night Shift. So then I'm going to stand by It's a Mixed Bag. Because, I mean, now if you give me Henry Winkler killing somebody on a merry-go-round in Night Shift, no good talk.
Is there a one to grow on half the battle moment in this film?
You know, stick with the sax. Don't follow your dreams.
I was going to say, you can't trust anyone who's ever fallen in love with the saxophone.
Let's just be honest. If there's one to grow on, if you're at someone's apartment for the first time, check for open windows.
Especially if you're going to play catch with their dog.
Threw it harder. Like, he doesn't know the layout of this apartment at all.
How about close your windows when it's raining? If it's
good. You're already true. Thank you. Yeah, you're already risking knocking over a blender by throwing it harder into a room you're not aware of what's going on.
A little bit of feedback for you, Steve.
Alrighty.
This was not sent to our regular email account, which is cocoonsofhorror@gmail.com. But I got an email and it has some really nice things to say about you, Steve.
Those are some of my favorites.
Yeah, this is from JJ. He says, unironically, when Steve really gets impressed, is there anyone who can incisively encapsulate what unique unnoticed element caught his attention, why, and how it does this more brilliantly or passionately better than he does? I don't think so. people that are funny are inevitably brilliant. Hey.
Wow.
So I think that that's a really nice email.
Is this me trying to wax poetic about Howard the Duck?
It must be. But I like this, and I wanted to call this out because I think that in general, when we get reviews or emails that compliment you, they really kind of focus on your sense of humor, which is not a, you know, you're a stand-up comedian. You probably do care about that.
Sure.
Maybe more than most. But I think that this person has said something true about you. I don't think that this podcast works unless you're bringing something to the table intellectually. And I agree with this guy. And that is all I have to say about that.
Well, that's interesting because you, on my end, you completely cut out.
Well, I was just saying a lot of really nice things, and you'll never hear them. Since you do not listen to this podcast, you'll never hear what I just said.
This one I may actually tune into because you've got a great teaser.
Cocoon of horror.